Welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Benjamin Levy, an assistant professor of oncology and clinical director of medical oncology at the Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center. We spoke about some of the recent advances in the management of patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. Levy detailed the standard of care, gaps in existing treatment, the impact of the IMpower 133 trial, and so much more.
So, Dr. Levy, how common is small cell lung cancer?
Yeah, I think it's important to make the distinction between non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer, as these are very different cancers. Those are the two main types of cancer. There's roughly 250,000 cases of lung cancer a year. And it looks like for small cell, the percentage of small cell is going down. So if you look back around maybe 5, 10, even 15 years ago, the percentage of small cell lung cancer was around 20% of all lung cancer. Now, that number has fallen over the past 10 years to about 10 to 15%. And that is probably reflective of the fact that small cell, as we'll talk about, is intimately associated with smoking and a heavy smoking history. And now that smoking rates are going down, small cell lung cancer cases are also going down. Still out there, still common. I still see it quite frequently in my office, but not as much as I'm seeing non-small cell lung cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what are the risk factors for small cell lung cancer?
Yeah, so it's pretty straightforward with small cell lung cancer. We really view small cell lung cancer through the prism of a smoking-related disease. There's an intimate association between smoking and small cell lung cancer, which is, again, important to make the distinction with non-small cell lung cancer. And we know that 20% of non-small cell lung cancer is never smokers. That is not the case for small cell. The main and really the sole risk factor for small cell lung cancer is smoking. I would say probably 95 to 98% of all small cell lung cancer patients have a smoking history and have heavy smoking history. Now, there are cases where you may have a small cell lung cancer not associated with smoking. There are de novo cases of small cell that occur that aren't smoking related, and we really don't know what the risk factor is. And then importantly, patients that are EGFR mutated, this is a type of non-small cell lung cancer, a certain percentage of those patients, when they have disease progression on a targeted therapy, it can evolve into a small cell lung cancer. And it's a unique phenomenon. We're still trying to iron this out and how best to treat it. But that is a scenario where you may have a small cell lung cancer that is not related to a prior smoking history.
Okay. And what are the stages of small cell lung cancer? And what is the typical course of progression?
Yeah. Again, always important to make distinctions between non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer when we're talking about staging. In non-small cell lung cancer, we have several stages, and the staging can even be quite nuanced. With small cell lung cancer, it's really quite straightforward. There is limited stage small cell and there's extensive stage. For limited stage, that basically means that the tumor can be encapsulated within a radiation field or viewed within a radiation field, and that radiation can target the entire tumor. So these are tumors that are generally confined to one lung or regional lymph nodes. And then you've got everything else, which is extensive stage lung cancer, which is essentially the lung cancer has moved outside of the lung into other parts of the body, most often the liver or the adrenal gland, unfortunately the brain, the bone. These are common scenarios that we see, or common types of patterns that we see with small cell lung cancer, extensive stage small cell lung cancer. Unfortunately, the majority of patients with small cell lung cancer present with extensive disease. So extensive disease comprises probably 75 to 80% of all small cell lung cancer, with only 20% being limited stage disease. That's an important distinction because it does drive treatment decisions. And we can certainly talk about those. But just briefly, limited stage small cell lung cancer, we're generally going for cure, although the rates are low. We're going for cure with a concurrent chemoradiation approach. And with extensive stage, we're unfortunately just going for palliation with systemic chemotherapy, with fortunately the advent of immunotherapy also playing a role in extensive stage disease.
Right. Absolutely. And what is the prognosis for patients with small cell lung cancer, and what are the known prognostic factors?
Yeah, so, you know, unfortunately, the prognosis for small cell lung cancer is certainly not as good as non-small cell lung cancer. In terms of some of the prognostic indicators that we know about, poor performance status is one. So patients who have a poor performance status generally don't do as well. Weight loss is certainly considered to be a poor prognostic indicator. The continuation of smoking that may contribute to chemotherapy resistance. And also the extent of the disease is certainly going to correlate with outcome. Also somewhat a little bit less understood is the paraneoplastic syndromes that occur with small cell, and that also, if they're there, can certainly cause issues in terms of worse outcome. When we look at the overall prognosis of small cell, unfortunately, this is a historically aggressive disease. It is difficult to treat. Responses happen with chemotherapy, but progression is generally universal. For limited stage small cell lung cancer, where you're going for cure, you can cure a percentage of patients. Roughly 10 to 15% of patients can be cured with limited stage disease. Unfortunately, a lot of those patients will relapse, and the median survival time for these patients is generally around a year and a half to 2 years. For extensive stage small cell, again, where the treatment all along is palliation and extension of life, we are looking again at median survival times that range anywhere from around 10 to 12 months, maybe a little bit higher. Of course, the advent of immunotherapy with chemotherapy, which we'll talk about, has improved outcomes, but we're still really wrestling with how to best treat these patients.
Okay. And so I think you kind of mentioned this, but what makes small cell lung cancer so difficult to treat?
It's such a relevant question and a good one. Why is it that small cell lung cancer is so difficult to treat? And I think we're still trying to understand this. You know, some of the data that was originally put out with immunotherapy was that immunotherapy worked best for patients who smoked the most. And this is a smoking-related cancer. And so you would think that immunotherapy would really work well for small cell. And I would say the gains we've witnessed with immunotherapy have been modest. So this is a complex tumor biology. We're still trying to understand the underlying genomic features that make this so hard. These tumors are rapidly dividing. They have a proclivity to metastasize early. Unfortunately, they develop resistance the resistance happens fairly in a short amount of time. So while chemotherapy can kill these cells, they are prone to resistance and grow aggressively. And I hope I have better answers if you would ask this question in the next maybe 5 to 10 years of why is it this tumor biology is so complex? It's fraught with genetic mutations. It has a high tumor mutation burden. And this translates into being a historically aggressive disease.
I want to kind of shift gears to the standard of care, though. So what is the standard of care for small cell lung cancer at the various stages of the disease?
Yeah. So for limited stage small cell lung cancer, the standard of care really hasn't budged over the past 10, 15 years. We generally want to deliver concurrent chemo radiation. The radiation oncologist can decide whether it's twice a day radiation or daily radiation, or there's been data that twice daily radiation may be better. And then it's chemotherapy with platinum etoposide concurrently with radiation. Now, generally, when we're going for cure, I try to give cisplatin-based chemotherapy rather than carboplatin. Although there is data to suggest that carboplatin may be as good as cisplatin in the limited stage setting, certainly in the extensive stage setting. So we generally offer concurrent chemo radiation. We give the chemotherapy concurrently while they're getting the radiation. The question is, for limited stage lung cancer, should we offer what we call prophylactic cranial irradiation to the brain? We should at least make that referral to the radiation oncologist to have that discussion. We know that PCI or prophylactic cranial irradiation does improve survival for limited stage small cell lung cancer. It's a risk-benefit discussion with the radiation oncologist once the chemo radiation is complete. For extensive stage lung cancer, certainly the treatment options have evolved. The same platinum etoposide that I mentioned to you that used concurrently with radiation has also been the cornerstone treatment for extensive stage lung cancer. So generally, carboplatin or cisplatin is given on day one. Etoposide is given day one, two, and three. And it's given every 21 days for four cycles. And prior to the advent of immunotherapy, we really didn't have any other strategies. We've looked at maintenance strategies. We've looked at continuing the chemotherapy beyond four cycles. And we really haven't made many gains to this strategy. Of course, recently we had the advent of immunotherapy. We'll talk about in the next segments. And this has really moved the field forward over the last two, three, 4 years. So patients with extensive stage lung cancer, the standard used to be platinum etoposide, followed by nothing really. Platinum etoposide for 4 to 6 cycles and then watch. And then maybe consider using prophylactic corneal radiation for extensive stage. I will tell you, in extensive stage, PCI, unlike limited stage, has a less significant benefit, and it's probably newer data would suggest it shouldn't be used. But recently we've had two studies that have shown that if you add immunotherapy to platinum etoposide regimens and compare that to platinum etoposide alone, there is an improvement in outcome. And so, that for sure has changed the paradigm for patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. And we'll certainly talk about the EMPOWER and the CASPIAN study. And I would also say in the second line, we have new treatment options for patients, at least for extensive stage disease. A drug called lubrinectedin has been recently evaluated in a phase 2 study looking at single agent activity of this drug after platinum etoposide for patients who have resistance on platinum etoposide, as showing meaningful outcomes with response rates that are north of 30% and the survivals at anywhere from 9 to 12 months. And that's in the platinum refractory setting. The phase 3 study, unfortunately, of lubrinectedin was a negative study. So this drug got approved based on a phase 2 study, but then the phase 3 was negative. So it's still there to be used. But when a head-to-head comparison was done with topotecan, it did not show a survival advantage. Nevertheless, given the fact that we do not have any second-line drugs that really work in extensive stage small cell lung cancer, I would make the argument that off of a clinical trial, lubrinectedin should be considered for patients.
Okay. So if you take a look back over the past 10, even 20 years at this point, how have the treatment options for this disease evolved?
Yeah, I think, and I mentioned this in my last answer, I would say in two fronts. One is the addition of immunotherapy with checkpoint inhibitors have improved survival in the front line. So clearly, IO therapy has made a meaningful impact for patients in the front line. Two would be the role of second-line drugs like lubrinectedin, which has shown response rates anywhere from 30 to 40% in refractory patients to platinum etoposide. So certainly we have some new second-line options that are available. And then there are other strategies that are being looked at. I think that one of the things that has sort of weaved its way into some of these trials is the role of consolidative radiation. So if patients get platinum etoposide and have a nice response, or platinum etoposide with IO and have a nice response in the lung, should there be a role for consolidative radiation? And the data has been mixed on that. And the data runs right up to the role of immunotherapy as well, because we're usually in these patients continuing the immunotherapy and not breaking for radiation. But there may be a role also for radiation as well. So I think all of these strategies, IO strategies, second line strategies, and potentially radiation, some roles for radiation may continue to move the field forward. But certainly we didn't have these in the past 5 to 10 years, and it's changed recently for win for our patients. Mm-hmm,
definitely. And so what have we learned about predictive factors for treatment response? And in particular, does biomarker testing play a role in the treatment decision-making today for extensive stage small cell lung cancer?
Yeah, this is, again, another important distinction between non-small cell lung cancer. If you take non-small cell lung cancer, you can really parse out non-small cell lung cancer into these distinct genetic subsets that can be wedded to what we call genotype-directed therapies or targeted therapies. And then even patients that don't have a genotype, if they have a high PD-L1, you can offer these patients with non-small cell lung cancer, potentially single-agent checkpoint inhibitor. This has not been the case with small cell lung cancer. Unfortunately, we are still scratching the surface and only have a nascent understanding of reliable predictive biomarkers, either in tissue or in plasma, that may help us decide. So, you know, a lot of data and from the Empower study, which we'll look at, looked at plasma TMB, looked at PD-L1. None of these seem to predict response to immunotherapy, the new agents. And even prior to immunotherapy, we didn't have a lot of predictive factors either in tissue or in plasma that played a role. I think that this will change. We're coming up now with potentially four distinct subsets genetically of small cell lung cancer. And one of these subsets may be responsive to PARP inhibitors. But currently, the standard is really, you don't need to test for PD-L1 in small cell. You don't need to do any genetic testing right now, although this may come soon. And you don't need to look anything in the plasma. Right now, for all patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, generally offering them platinum etoposide with preferably an IO agent, if IO eligible, and then continuing that IO until progression.
Now I want to kind of switch gears to the extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So how is extensive stage disease defined and how does it differ from metastatic small cell lung cancer?
So extensive stage small cell lung cancer is metastatic small cell lung cancer. That's important. There's only two stages of small cell lung cancer, a limited stage and extensive stage. And really these two could be used interchangeably. All extensive stage means is that the tumor is outside of the field where you can get the entire tumor within a radiation field. So commonly patients come in with bone mets or brain mets or liver mets or adrenal gland involvement. So these two words are used interchangeably.
Okay. And what percentage of patients first present with extensive stage small cell lung cancer?
Yeah, unfortunately, roughly 75 to 80% of all small cell lung cancer patients are extensive stage. And that's unfortunate because the goals at that point when a patient is extensive stage is palliation and not cure. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't treat these patients. I just think we need to have honest conversations with them about what the intent of therapies are. So it's 80% of patients are extensive stage. I will tell you in my practice, Most, if not all, of my small cell lung cancer patients are extensive stage.
Okay. And what are the challenges that are specific to treating this stage of the disease?
Yeah, I think this was touched upon in one of the last questions in the intro is, you know, extensive stage small cell lung cancer, the challenges really relate to small cell in general. Unfortunately, when this presents, number one, it's outside of the lung. It's in multiple areas of the body that can cause havoc on patients. It can really impact on their quality of life. It can cause pain. It can cause neurological symptoms if they have brain metastases. This is a tumor that is extraordinarily complex biologically. Its tumor microenvironment can be hostile, and it has a proclivity to metastasize very early and its growth. All of these factors make it really, really difficult to treat. The other challenge is that while chemotherapy works for extensive stage small cell lung cancer and immunotherapy works for extensive stage small cell lung cancer, you know, the small cell lung cancer is Darwinian in nature. It wants to survive, and it really starts to have a lot of resistance mechanisms that are at play that make it resistant to the treatment that it was initially responsive to.
And what is the prognosis for patients at this stage?
You know, unfortunately, even with the advent of immunotherapy, the prognosis is still poor. You're looking at survival times anywhere from 10 to 12 months, maybe a little bit higher, 13 months in some of the studies. And I try never to assign a number to a patient when they come in. They ask questions about this. I think we have to be balanced and say, you know, let's see how you do. We know that there are outliers that do very well with chemotherapy, with immunotherapy. But unfortunately, the prognosis, you can't cure these patients. And it's usually the survival times anywhere from 10 to 13 months.
Okay. What are some of the unmet needs in this patient population?
So the unmet needs are many. We need additional therapies for this patient population. We need a better understanding genomically of what's going on. We've done such a fabulous job in non-small cell lung cancer, discovering and elucidating the genomic underpinnings of the tumor. And we haven't made a lot of forward progress yet. We're getting there with small cells. So a better understanding of the genomic underpinnings, a better understanding of the tumor microenvironment, and really a better understanding how to leverage therapies, not just immunotherapies, but other novel therapies to improve the outcomes. And with non-small cell lung cancer, you know, there's a list that we can talk about of things on the horizons that we know on the horizon that we know is going to get approved in the next 6 to 12 months. There's probably 4 or 5 drugs and non-small cell lung cancer that I can tell you right now by January 2022 are probably going to be approved. I cannot do the same in small cell. And that just tells you again how aggressive and complex this tumor is and how challenging it can be to treat.
So Dr. Levy, what have been the response rates with standard of care frontline therapies in patients with extensive stage disease?
Yeah, I think what we know about platinum etoposide, its ability to elicit responses in small cell lung cancer is meaningful. Unfortunately, it's not durable. So platinum etoposide, if given to an extensive stage small cell lung cancer patient, you know, the response rates can be 70 to 80%. That's meaningful. That really is, you know, you can really make an impact on a small cell lung cancer patient right away by giving them platinum etoposide to elicit these high responses. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, these responses, unlike others in non-small cell lung cancer, are not durable. We often get a response that lasts maybe 2 or 3 months, if 4 months, and then growth starts to happen again. Not for all patients, but for some. So I think, you know, this is where there's a need to add additional treatments to help not only responses, but also help sustain responses and to keep the tumor in check.
Right. So with that, what is the rationale for wanting to add immunotherapy in this setting?
Well, I think that there's a lot of rationale. Number one, we know that chemotherapy alone can promote antigen release to antigen presenting cells. So we know that chemotherapy may be a nice partner with immunotherapy. And we know that this is a tumor that has a high tumor mutation burden, is heavily associated with smoking. Both of these factors we know are a nice template to leverage immunotherapy. Smoking-related cancers, high tumor mutation burden, and adding it with chemotherapy, which may facilitate presentation of these tumor-specific antigens, this is ripe for looking at potential synergy, adding on immunotherapy to chemotherapy.
Okay, and which patients are eligible for immunotherapy in the frontline setting, and does PD-L1 status matter?
Yeah, it's a great question. Not all patients with extensive stage lung cancer are going to be eligible. Most are for immunotherapy. I mean, the natural selection here is in any tumor type. You know, if a patient has autoimmune diseases that prohibit the patient to get immunotherapy, not all. If a patient has an organ transplant, these are the things. They're rare, but we do see patients that cannot get immunotherapy. Most patients can get immunotherapy with small cell lung cancer. You know, unlike non-small cell lung cancer, PD-L1 doesn't really make a difference. We use the immunotherapy in combination with chemotherapy, no matter what the PD-L1 is, which is, you don't need to wait for the PD-L1. It's not like non-small cell lung cancer. You can go ahead once that diagnosis is made and move forward with treatment.
So Dr. Levy, has the withdrawal of the pembrolizumab indication for metastatic small cell lung cancer affected treatment options for extensive stage disease?
I don't think so. You know, the pembrolizumab indication was, you know, in the second and third line. It actually was, I think, in third line. And it really did not make a difference. Now that immunotherapy has moved frontline, having that immunotherapy beyond first line is really not needed. So I don't think it shifted anything for us in terms of treatment algorithms or in terms of what we're doing with our patients or in terms of expectations.
Okay, great. And what other immunotherapies have been used or tried in this population?
Well, I think two, and we will talk about those, that have made a firm place, have a firm place in extensive stage small cell lung cancer. One, of course, is atezolizumab, which we'll talk about from the IMpower 133, and the other is durvalumab from the Caspian study. There have been other strategies. A combination of nivolumab plus ipilimumab has been looked at. Mm-hmm. In the refractory setting for pretreated patients who've progressed on a platinum doublet, that's been looked at as well. And then you mentioned that single agent nivolumab and pembrolizumab have been looked at in the second and third line. And so I think fortunately we do have some traction and survival gains with the addition of immunotherapy with either atezolizumab or durvalumab in the front line with extensive stage small cell lung cancer.
I want to focus on IMpower 133. So yeah. What was the design of the study and what kind of patients were included?
Yeah, so these were patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. And they basically were patients. It was a very simple design. These are patients with measurable disease, had a preserved performance status, and were treatment naive. Patients with treated brain mets were eligible on this study. And this trial, IMpower 133, took about 400 patients and randomized them one-to-one, very simple, to either carboplatin or etoposide. Carboplatin was given at an AUC of 5 day 1. Etoposide was 100 milligrams per meter squared day 1, 2, 3, given every 21 days, versus carboplatin etoposide with the addition of atezo every 21 days for 4 cycles. And then the atezolizumab was allowed as maintenance every 3 weeks to be, patients could be treated until progression or toxicity. And then of course, in the other arm, it was a placebo. Now, remember I talked to you about prophylactic cranial radiation. This could be done per the standard of care, but that was allowed. And so that was the main design. The primary endpoint, there were two. One was overall survival. The other was investigated assessed PFS. And then you had your secondary endpoints of response rate, duration of response, and safety.
Okay. And what were the findings on the key efficacy endpoints?
Yeah, I think I'll just get to the bottom line. There was really no difference in response rates. Immunotherapy did not elicit more response than chemotherapy alone. The three drugs, there was no higher response rate than two drugs. And that's because chemo alone does such a good job of eliciting responses in small cell. There's very little difference in progression-free survival. I think the biggest news that came out of this was there was an overall survival advantage. So the patients in the chemo IO arm, carboplatin, etoposide, atezo, had a median survival time of 12.3 months. In the placebo group, it was 10.3 months. The hazard ratio is 0.7. That was statistically significant. So there was roughly a 2-month benefit in overall survival. Some people look at that and say, wow, just 2 months with immunotherapy when we see bigger gains in non-small cell lung cancer. But you have to remember that this is a disease where we are hungry and we have not seen survival advantages in a very long time. So I would make the case that, you know, clearly survival, median survival times that are improved by 2 months are meaningful here. If we looked at the landmark survivals at 12 months and 18 months, there was improvements as well. I mean, 34% of patients at 18 months were still alive on the chemo IO arm, which is pretty meaningful compared to just 21% in the chemo arm. So I think this, again, this solidified atezolizumab as a standard of care. Importantly, we always have to look at safety with immunotherapy in combination with chemotherapy. And there were really no new safety signals here. And I know this is a big question. Okay, you added the IO to the chemo and you saw the survival advantage of 2 months, but did this cause more toxicity? And the bottom line is that there weren't any more adverse events, specifically immune-related adverse events, with the triplet therapy than we generally see with IO therapy alone. So the drugs were well tolerated overall, and safety was not compromised by adding immunotherapy to chemotherapy. And because of that, you know, NCCN made this a category one recommendation in 2019. The FDA approved it in 2019. NCCN made it a category one preferred option. So I think this is an option. This is one option that should be leveraged for patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer.
What are the overall implications of EMPOWER 133 for clinical practice now that you just mentioned it's approved and the NCCN added it to its guidelines?
Yeah, I think this is a new standard of care for patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. And this regimen should be considered in all patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, unless they have some contraindication to immunotherapy.
Right, absolutely. And how will you incorporate atezolizumab into your treatment planning?
Every patient who comes here is a candidate. Because this regimen came first, we generally use carboplatin etoposide with atezo. We give four cycles. We give the carboplatin atezo on day one. We do the etoposide day 1, 2, 3. We do that every 21 days for four cycles. And then we continue the atezolizumab until progression. We do not offer PCI or prophylactic corneal radiation for our patients. We think that the data now would suggest that there really is no survival advantage as long as you monitor patients with brain MRIs every 3 to 4 months. And so this has been practice changing for us.
Great. And what are the implications of this approval for patients?
Well, I think that, this is clearly a practice changing trial. We have another practice changing trial, right? We have the addition of durvalumab in combination with platinum etoposide, the Caspian study. They show the same thing. So we've got really two now strategies with carboplatin etoposide atezo and carboplatin etoposide durva, both showing survival advantages. It's dealer's choice in terms of the institution that you're at, which you use. I think having both of these options are important. I can tell you at our institution, because EMPOWER 133 came first, this is the option that we generally use. I see no difference between these two regimens, and this is the one that we generally use in our practice.
Okay, so looking ahead, what do you see happening in the future in terms of immunotherapy and small cell lung cancer?
You know, this is a great question. Where are we heading? If we look at choosing the right strategy moving forward, it's a lot like throwing darts at a dartboard and seeing what sticks, or seeing what lands, or throwing spaghetti on a wall and seeing what sticks. I mean, I think we're just not there yet. I think what we have learned over the past maybe 3 years is that there are potentially distinct small cell lung cancer subsets based on gene expression profile, which these distinctions may inform us of the right therapy to use. And then there are other drugs that are on the horizon. Certainly antibody drug conjugates are being still looked at despite Rova-T's lack of benefit in a phase 3 trial. There are epigenetic modifiers that are being looked at. PARP inhibitors may have a role in distinct genetic subsets, as I've mentioned before. Arginine inhibitors are being looked at. And then a whole host of immunotherapy strategies, bispecific T-cell engager antibodies, CAR T-cell may play a role at some point. So the future is bright. Whether we get there in 5 years or 10 years, I just don't know, but I look forward to it. We've made a lot of gains with immunotherapy with the addition of either durvalumab or atezolizumab with platinum etoposide. I think the future looks good. It's just gonna take a little bit more while to sort out who the right patient is and what the right drugs are.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Levy.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to your podcast. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you again next time.